everybody. Welcome to episode 9 of the Fearless Flyer podcast. And in this episode, we will be concluding our third part on the series on weather. And in this one, we're talking about extreme weather. So we'll be looking at items such as wind, strong winds, wind shear, hail, ice, snow, etc. But more importantly, my co-host. Welcome, James.
Hey, Grant. Yeah, it's good to be back. It's a nice afternoon here. So I'm excited to learn a bit more in depth about the effects of this sort of extreme weather and how what it can do to aircraft.
Yeah. This is going to be one of the interesting ones because, as I say, it's the extreme weather that seems to generate a lot of people's or contribute to a lot of people's anxiety. So we'll talk about that. In the last episode, we discussed clouds and fog. And so this is probably an extension going on from there, because as we said in the last one, we gather a lot of information from clouds about what's happening around the atmosphere. So this is a good finish up on weather and especially the extremes of weather. What should we start on, James?
Do you want to start on wind?
We all know what wind is, but we're talking more like about strong wind. So wind is, it's created by a different pressure gradients within the atmosphere. So basically on a nice summer's day with a high pressure system present, we have very little wind, but a low pressure day will bring the isobars closer together, which means stronger winds. And a really low pressure day is, it's generally associated with a storm and thus has very strong winds. At altitude, you won't notice the wind, but it is significant as it affects our ground speed, either favorably if it's behind us or detrimentally if we're going into one. However, as we get near the ground on very windy days, the air gets mixed up a lot as it goes over obstacles, whether they be hills, trees, ridges, or buildings. And it can be quite turbulent near the ground with this type of turbulence. And therefore, it's like an obstacle-induced turbulence. We call this mechanical turbulence, and it obviously reduces as we get further away from the ground. We can't avoid it during taking off and landing. It can try to throw us off our approach path, and we can mitigate this by flying a bit faster, which makes our controls more effective. There are limits imposed by the manufacturers to the maximum speeds we're allowed to fly in. And if it goes over these limits, we either don't take off, or if we're in the air, we won't land. We'll divert to another airport. That's within the manufacturer's limits for that, for the particular aircraft we're flying. We'll talk more about winds that blow across the runway, which are called crosswinds, in another episode. Although most runways are designed so that they face into the prevailing wind, Mother Nature sometimes refuses to play nicely and might decide to blow the wind across the runway. But we'll talk about how we handle that in another episode.
So you're just talking about wind, and that can obviously, as a Grant just discussed, it can push you around a bit as you come closer to the ground. But the next element we wanted to discuss is associated with really strong gusty winds, and it's called wind shear. So it's basically the shearing motion of air when there's a big, large change in wind speed or direction. And this can occur in both a vertical or a horizontal direction, or a bit of both. And there's a few different variables that can create wind shear, but the main one is about cumulonimbus.
That's the one. Yeah, it is a hard word to say.
There's a few different like drivers that can create wind shear, but the main one we wanted to discuss here today was something we brought up last episode to do with cumulonimbus. Saying an N before the U.
I tell you what, get me involved. Just say storm clouds, which are called what, Grant? And I'll say, there you go. Okay.
So there's a few different drivers that can create wind shear. The main one we want to discuss, however, has to do with the big storm clouds, which we discussed last week. Do you remember what they are called?
Yes, I do remember, because someone's having trouble pronouncing it. So I'll say it for you. Cumulonimbus clouds.
Okay. And those are the big storm thunder clouds that when the people love discussing that generate all the rain. So anyway, how do they create wind shear? So underneath one of these thunderclouds, there's a lot of rain.
What type of cloud is it, James?
Cumulonimbus.
Yeah, that's close enough.
That's about as close as getting. Anyway, underneath these clouds, there's generally a lot of rain and sometimes some hail, depending on how cold it was. And that is pushing the air down because it's solid or a liquid pushing the air particles down. And as it hits the ground, this airflow that's being pushed down has to go somewhere because it obviously can't be absorbed into the ground. So it gets pushed out in a horizontal direction. So in the past, there have been a couple of accidents. The main cause has been aircraft encountering a wind shear event. So Grant, I believe you wanted to set up like a scenario, just discuss how this could occur.
Yeah, wind shear has caused quite a few incidents in the past and accidents. Basically, we'll give you a scenario. Let's just say an aircraft is 20 miles out from the runway. It's at 5,000 feet and you're lined up with the runway. And on your descent point, halfway between you and the runway is a small thunderstorm or a, what's it called, James?
Yeah, whatever.
Yeah, cumulonimbus.
Cumulonimbus. Yeah, cumulonimbus.
Yeah, that's it. Well done. Okay, so there's a small cumulonimbus cloud, thunderstorm cloud. The base of it's 3,000 feet and the tops of it, it's quite low. It's 18,000 feet. So there's a lot of rain coming out of the bottom of it. Now, my weather radar will show a lot of rain, but I see that the aircraft's going to pass underneath it on the approach, so it won't be in the cloud. But I will fly through the heavy rain that is falling beneath it on the approach. So what actually happens as the aircraft approaches where we are at 5,000 feet, 20 miles out, as it approaches on descent, the outflowing air causes the airspeed that we have in the airplane to increase, which generates more lift. Now, this is a positive situation. And so to keep on our glide path, we'll reduce the power, possibly pitch the nose of the aircraft down a little to keep on the correct approach path, or which we call glide path. Now, as we pass underneath this cloud, there's a lot of rain falling out of it. The aircraft wants to sink down due to the downgoing airflow associated with the falling rain. So we apply a bit of power and we may need to pitch the nose up a little to keep on that glide path. Now we're clear of the rain and we're getting lower and closer to the runway. The wind then changes direction and starts going in the direction the aircraft is going. This means we lose airspeed and thus lift is now reduced. We need to increase power and likely increase the pitch angle of the nose in an upwards direction. So this is not a good situation to be in. And this scenario is classic wind shear, starting with positive wind shear, but leading to negative wind shear situation as we get closer to the ground. Now, as James has already said, wind shears cause many aircraft to come down short of the runway. And in the past, as a result of accidents, a heck of a lot of research has been done to mitigate it. The ground radars that air traffic control use has significantly improved in order to give pilots information. The weather radars on board the aircraft are extremely advanced nowadays and will give us a warning that can predict wind shear by analyzing the movement of rain, the precipitation in the cloud. And the aircraft will also talk to us and it will use the weather radar and it will actually shout at us and say, wind shear ahead or go around wind shear ahead. And this scenario is called a predictive wind shear warning. Our reaction to this is to ascertain where the wind shear is and the likely result will be we'll do a go around, which means we throw away the approach and climb away from the airport. Now, the onboard system of the aircraft is very advanced. It has an internal system called a GPWS. Do you know what that stands for, James, in your studies?
Ground Proximity Warning System.
Yeah, well done, yeah. So the Ground Proximity Warning System, it has a lot of information coming into it, like rate of descent, airspeed, inertial data, and it detects if we are in wind shear and the aircraft will send numerous warnings at us. It'll give a warning like this.
Wind shear, wind shear, wind shear, wind shear, wind shear. Wind shear.
And also on our display, it'll show wind shear. There's a big red warning. And immediately upon hearing this warning, we do what's called a wind shear go around, which simply means we aggressively apply full power. We put the nose to initially 15 degrees on the horizon. This is the approximate nose attitude that you see with a plane taking off. We may disconnect the autopilot. We get the wings level. We check the speed, brakes retracted. During this event of wind shear, if we actually do fly into it, it can be rather bumpy and we'll just fly the aircraft in a nose up attitude until we get clear of the wind shear. So the onboard system is very good.
So as a from a pilot's perspective in the cockpit, is there anything else apart from these gauges shouting at you that you can use to sort of tell if there's going to be wind shear ahead?
Yeah, that's a good question. We do have some additional cues that we use to back up the electronic signals. And we're more alert for these when on the approach and passing below 1,000 feet above the runway. And these cues are things like a significant change of airspeed, a big change of rate of descent, which is different to our normal one, would be a lot higher rate of descent, for example, the thrust levers in an unusual position for a period of time, or an unusual pitch attitude of the aircraft or a few. So thanks to the research over the years, we also use a document in our operations manual that gives us the levels and possibility of wind shear if certain given atmospheric conditions exist. And as a result, we're more vigilant about how we operate. So for example, if there are storm clouds within a certain distance of the airfield, we may elect to take off in a different direction or not take off at all. In other words, we will take a more cautious approach as to how we operate the aircraft with these types of weather systems in the vicinity of the airport.
So from what you're saying, is there's a lot of system technology, both on the ground that air traffic control can use and aircraft systems that you use to detect the wind shear these days. There's also information that's been gathered over years of research on how to avoid and see wind shear in the first place. And this has led to procedures such as holding above an airport or diverting to another airport as storm set clouds offer of a transient nature. And so we'll put a link in the show notes to a PDF file if you want to learn anything more or else about wind shear. So we've discussed it a lot, but have you as a pilot actually encountered it before?
Yes, I have encountered it, but we obviously train in the simulator a lot for it, but I've never been in a situation where I've had to do a wind shear go around. We have the information we used before to basically prevent getting into the situation in the first place. However, the scenario I just talked about early on did happen to me in Africa once. I was starting an approach and there was one of these storm clouds, a cumulonimbus, above the start of the approach. And as we started the approach, the aircraft wasn't slowing as quickly as I wanted to because of this wind was changing significantly. And all the indications were there that this was going to be a problem as I got lower to the ground. So we threw away the approach quite early and just went and held for 20 minutes while the storm moved aside and then started the approach again. So yes, I've not had to react to a wind shear warning, but I have seen the indications that there could have been wind shear. So we just simply didn't do the landing.
Sweet. And I think that sums up wind shear and wind as a whole. We were next going to go on to really heavy rain and hail. Did you want to discuss how that can affect an aircraft?
Heavy rain's not a problem. The testing of these engines is incredible. And I will put a link into the show notes, a 2-minute video when they're testing a GE-NX engine, which is the new engine that's coming out on the 777X. But basically, they're putting in 800 gallons of water per minute. That's over 3,000 litres per minute through the engine, and it's still running at full power. Hail's obviously a bit worse because it's associated with those thunderstorms we talked about, the cumulonimbus clouds. Therefore, we like to avoid them because we're not only avoiding turbulence, but a potential hail encounter. Flying in hail is very noisy. There's a risk that you could damage the forward nose radome, which is the front of the airplane, or a worst case scenario, damage a window enough and it kind of makes it opaque. It's extremely difficult to look out of. So staying away from cumulonimbus clouds and areas of icing is a good starter to avoiding hail. If you had no choice but to get close to one, you'd just avoid the areas where there's a lot of cold rain, as that could be hail. So yeah, there'll be a video in the show notes, and that's showing them pumping water and hail into an engine because they have to do a lot of testing before they're certified to go on to a commercial aircraft. And it's a damn sight more than the heaviest rainstorms that we'll ever encounter.
Fair enough. And then moving on from rain, so snow, how does it affect an aircraft?
A lot of research being done on this because many years ago there were, you know, accidents. Very famous one with a football team in Germany, an English football team. I can't remember, it's a long time ago, well before I was born, but they're not good as those types of contaminants make our aircraft heavier, but it also can disrupt the smooth airflow over the wing, thereby significantly reducing lift. Contaminants on the runway can significantly impact upon our takeoff performance because the snow not only slows the acceleration of the aircraft on takeoff, but also the deceleration on landing because the brakes are potentially skidding. So for us, de-icing of the aircraft is carried out as close as possible to departure time. This will involve spraying a de-icing fluid all over the wings and tail. And if it's still snowing, we'll then apply another coating of anti-icing fluid. These fluids have different colors depending on the concentration level of the applied fluid and how heavy the snowfall is. This will give us a certain time frame that we have to be airborne in. And if we don't meet that time frame, we're required to do the whole de-icing procedure again. As for contaminants on the runway, whether that be snow or heavy amounts of water, we take that into account on our takeoff or landing calculations. And airports, they also do groom the runways to remove snow as well. Suffice to say, a lot of research has been done on contaminations, and as a result, we'll always err on the side of caution. And if we're not 100% sure, we de-ice the aircraft. Simple as that.
So that's talking about it on the ground, but in the air, can this event occur? Can ice be built up on the aircraft while in flight?
Yes, it can. And the aircraft systems are obviously designed to either prevent ice buildup or remove ice on the wings and the engines during flight. So the ice buildup really only occurs on the front of the wing or around the engine intake cowling or on propeller aircraft. This might be the leading edge of the propeller. So de-icing in flight is generally done by pumping hot air into channels on the leading edge of the wing, the front of the wing. And so it warms them up. The same with the engine nacelles. Warm air gets pumped in there. And this has an effect of heating that surface up and thus melting the ice away. Propeller aircraft will generally have an electrically heated leading edge, so that'll melt the ice away. And older, slow aircraft might have even had pneumatic boots on the front, so it's a rubber boot along the leading edge, and they would pump air into them and they'd inflate and then break the ice off. What else is de-iced or anti-iced? Our pilot windshields, they're electrically heated to prevent ice buildup and stop fogging. How does that sound? Anything else you can think of there, James?
With the Dash 8s I used to work on, they had little rubber blow-up things in the front of the leading edge that blew up.
That's more the slow aircraft, the turboprop aircraft
you say. Or Dash 8s. So, lightning, another extreme weather event. Did you want to discuss?
Yeah. So, lightning. I've been hit by lightning 4 times in my career so far. So far, that is. It's worth understanding why there is absolutely no harm to you or the aircraft. The last known incident whereby lightning caused a plane to crash was way back in 1963. And the information that came out of that and previous incidents with regard to lightning ensured that future designs would be lightning proof. A lightning bolt contains a huge amount of current, but as we're sitting in an aluminium tube, we're in essence sitting in a modern marvel called a Faraday cage. Now, I know you're all excited and you want to know what a Faraday cage is. It's simply a hollow shell made out of metal that conducts electricity. A few days ago, I was talking to a friend of mine and I asked him if he wanted to have a chat about this lightning because he's not only an airline pilot, but he's a registered electrician. So I couldn't ask for a better person to speak about lightning. So here's Mark and I a few days ago having a chat.
Electricity, lightning or any other form of electricity, it always wants to take the path of least resistance to the ground. In the instance of an aeroplane, when an aeroplane gets hit by lightning, it's because the lightning's passing through the air and it's decided that the path through the aeroplane is the path of least resistance to get then further or closer to the ground, and then it pops out closer to the ground, usually out of the tail, and then continues down and hits the ground. So when the lightning hits the aeroplane, the lightning is traveling through the path of least resistance. And because the aircraft is completely bonded, that means that all the metal parts of the aeroplane, they've all been electrically connected together with wire. They call it earthing bonding, that sort of thing. And because the aeroplane is a Faraday cage, so every part of the aeroplane is electrically connected to every other part of the aeroplane. So the electricity hits the front of the plane usually and then travels around the outside of the aeroplane in most cases, so along the metal skin of the aeroplane and pops out the back and continues to the ground. And in most occasions, there's very little damage, if any damage to the airplane because everything in the airplane is at the same potential because it's all bonded together.
So the people in the airplane won't feel anything. All they'll probably hear is a bang.
In many cases, the airplane can get hit by lightning and people inside the airplane won't even know that it's actually happened. They quite often will, if the window shades are up, you'll see the flash and you might hear the bang. And sometimes you'll get lightning hit the airplane and there is no bang just because of the type of lightning that there is. Because the airplane is completely bonded all together and you're inside the airplane, so lightning, like any electrical charge, it wants to take the path of least resistance, and it's along the outside metal part of the airplane and not through any people or chairs or carpet. Okay.
So that makes sense.
Some magician shows have this a show where the magician gets electrocuted. Usually they're wearing a medieval chainmail. And he touches the electricity and it's very dramatic. Lots of lightning. It goes through him, but it goes around the outside of him.
So he's fully insulated within that jacket.
Yeah, insulated is the right word, but the thing is that the metal, because it conducts electricity so well, electricity takes the path of least resistance.
Okay.
So it looks really good when you're looking at a magician doing this going, wow, how is he managing to do that? It's because he's sitting like inside the aeroplane with the metal skin of the aeroplane on the outside. He's not getting hurt and he's wearing chainmail. He doesn't even feel it because the electricity takes the path of least resistance.
So basically summing it up.
No, it's not an issue. I don't think there's any recorded incidents where an aircraft has crashed because of the lightning strike.
There was one way early on, and I think it was the 60s, where it wasn't bonded, was the thing. There was no earthing issue, and it was to do with a fuel tank. But yeah,
bonding is the thing that needs to be required, and by and engineers on aeroplanes, I think, check this quite often.
So, from Mark, a registered electrician and a airline pilot, a captain with the airline that I work for. You've heard from Mark. He is the man in the know and he's got the experience in the background to give you the definitive answer.
Oh, it's very kind of you to say so.
So that was Mark. He probably explained it a lot better than I could, and being an electrician makes it obviously a lot easier. So the charge is just on the outside of the fuselage and it just redistributes itself and the inside basically remains uncharged. Now, the issue is the aircraft needs to get rid of this electrical energy. So on the wingtips, at the rear of the wing, normally on the ailerons, but also on the rear of the horizontal stabilizer and the vertical fin, there are a number of pencil-sized wicks sticking out, and these are called static discharge wicks. And the energy from where the lightning has struck the aircraft, they all accumulate there. These static discharge wicks dissipate the electrical energy back into the atmosphere. What you may experience in the cabin is a loud bang, but as you're in a tube, as Mark says, it won't affect us. But in essence, the aircraft can get struck by lightning all day. What you'll hear maybe is a bang, and after a while, that would start to annoy you. Sometimes where the lightning does strike the aircraft, there can be a tiny burn mark or even a tiny hole. It may pop out some rivets. It's not an issue that will affect the aircraft, and the maintenance folk can rectify it when it lands.
So you earlier said that you've been struck 4 times by lightning. Do you want to describe what it's like?
Yeah, the first time I was in a place called Kakera in Greece, which is an island of Corfu. And we'd landed, I just joined a holiday airline. I was a first officer on the 757. And there were lots of isolated thunderstorms around. And we were all standing there chatting, looking at the thunderstorms all around us. Then after that, we went inside. We got the jet ready to return to the UK. And in the meantime, unbeknown to us, one of these thunderstorms had arrived over the airfield just as we were about to take off. We couldn't see it above us, and there was a lot of lightning going on around outside. So as we get airborne, there was a kind of like a light shining forward from the aircraft. And I said to the captain, that's interesting. And he was about to say, I don't think that's very good. And then bang, right in front of my window, we got struck by lightning. And all I remember is, my eyesight went red and then black, and I could feel with my hands for the autopilot. So I pressed that, no idea what was happening with the aircraft for a nanosecond. So basically the bright flash in front of me had temporarily blinded me for probably about 5 seconds. When my vision came back, there was nothing wrong with the airplane at all. The autopilot was working. It was climbing away. Yeah, so that was my first experience, and that did put a little hole just in front of me after we landed. We opened up the window and had a look, and there's a tiny hole. Another time coming out of Auckland, we were full of fuel going back to the Middle East, and there were four pilots, so two captains and two co-pilots. And I was the augmenting crew, so I was sitting on the jump seat. And as we turned on the climb out of Auckland, so we're full of fuel, it's going to be a 17-hour flight. And I saw the same pattern with a light shining off the nose as we went into the side of a cloud. And it seems to be a static buildup of the aircraft. And I said to my co-pilot, leant over and said, have you ever been hit by lightning before? He goes, no. And I said, we're about to be. And halfway through saying we're about to, we got hit. And it made a big bang. It blew some rivets off, we discovered after landing. But once again, plane's perfectly all right. So can we avoid it? Yeah, staying away from thunderstorm clouds is a good idea. But sometimes you can be a long way away from a cloud and you can get struck by lightning. It's an extremely rare occurrence, but it's of no consequence to aircraft. But if we're in the vicinity of lightning and it's nighttime, we turn the lighting on the flight deck to ensure we aren't blinded on the remote chance that we do get a free lightning strike.
Did you want to discuss volcanoes?
Volcanic ash, although not weather related, it does mess with the atmosphere. The ash that's ejected into the atmosphere, it's very erosive and it can cause damage to the leading edge parts of the aircraft. So that's the front of the wings, the nose, pilot's windows, the engine inlet nacelles, turbine blades. So there are two issues here. Firstly, it might do enough damage to prevent us as pilots seeing out the window. And secondly, the engine can get clogged up with volcanic ash, and obviously a clogged up engine, that doesn't sound very good. So we do get very up-to-date information about volcanic eruptions, both before the flight with excellent satellite images of the movement of the cloud, the charts that give us upper air winds as well. And during the flight, our operations team also send us any changes. So avoidance of the area is the way to mitigate such a threat. And nowadays, airlines tend to be a lot more cautious about their approach, almost to a point of frustration. So if you remember in 2010 when that Icelandic volcano erupted, do you know how to pronounce that? I've got no idea.
The Evlug, I don't know.
The volcano in Iceland erupted. We've got it written down here, but it's, I don't want to even try. Anyway, but half of the European aviation was grounded while there were clear blue skies everywhere. So highly frustrating, but overcautious maybe, but aircraft simply do not like the fine particles associated with volcanic ash.
So, yeah, volcanic ash, it goes pretty high up, as you mentioned. We also mentioned right at the last episode that you're going to say something about space weather. I'm sure a lot of people are curious about what that was all about. So did you want to say if space weather affects an aircraft?
Yeah, it does. It's weird, eh? Space weather, it does affect our aircraft. The primary concern for us regarding space weather, and that's from our sun, which is only 150 million kilometers away, it's pumping out radiation all the time, or a constant stream of particles known as the solar wind. And it's this wind that generates a large magnetic field. So sometimes the sun gets excited and it pumps out such thing as solar flares, which basically increases the solar wind strength. So the Earth's magnetic field offers us some protection, but in essence, a strong solar wind can have an effect on the GPS, the Global Position System navigation systems, high-frequency radio communications, and even ground power distribution. The good news is most of these effects are felt at the higher latitudes. So that's basically up near the poles. So to mitigate space weather, we get reports from the U.S. government Space Agency Prediction Center called NOAA, or the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. If any changes occur in flight, we're notified. We have three different charts, one for radio blackouts, one for solar radiation, and one for geomagnetic storms. And within these three charts are five scales, which tell us different information. So I'm not going to bore you with them here, but I've put a link in the show notes to show you what they mean and generally how we react to them.
So you say this is only occurs at high latitudes. So you've been to high latitudes and encountered this then?
I've done over 60 North Pole crossings, and before we go above a certain latitude, we check in with our company, which checks the NOAA website, and they give us an update as to what the solar winds are doing and the different levels. The last geomagnetic storm that I was in was over northern Canada, and it was only a level 2, but it gave us a spectacular view of the northern lights. It was really impressive. Needless to say, it's only a consideration if you're going up over the North Pole area. And if it were bad, we basically just simply descend. Yeah, so that's...
Yeah, so we've discussed quite a bit in this episode. We've gone over wind shear and how they affect aircraft. But through a lot of research over the last few decades, we've come to be able to realize when these events are going to occur and how to avoid them more, thus sort of mitigating the risk that they pose to the aircraft. The same goes for heavy rain, which is, as you've said, not really an issue at all for an aircraft with the way the engines are tested. Hail, ice, snow, and contamination of the airframe can be a bit more of an issue, but there are ways, again, that you guys can avoid it. And when you're on the ground, using anti-icing and de-icing to prevent any ice buildup over your wings during takeoff. And then lightning, which I'm sure people thought would have been a bit more dangerous than it really is. It's not really an issue at all. Yeah, space has only a tiny issue if you go over the North Pole. Or would it also be the South Pole? Because there is Southern Lights.
Yes, the Southern Lights, yes. No, you are correct. But as most planes very rarely take that route, it's of no consequence. But if there was an airway opened, it would have the same effect as if you're going over the North Pole. Yes.
And then volcanic ash, which can have a huge amount of disruption. But the easiest way, if anything like that happens, is just to ground the planes. And I think that sums up the whole episode.
We've looked at these extreme weather events here, but, you know, we fly aeroplanes 24 hours a day, 365 days of the year, and 99.999% of the time, we don't see any of these issues. And when they do occur, we've got strategies to limit their impact upon us. And generally, that limitation will be on the conservative side. And as a result, there's been a heck of a lot less incidents or accidents in the past 20 years because we use these mitigating strategies. So yeah, that sums it up. And that finishes our third part on weather. So I hope that was informative to you. The next episode, we're going to talk about high altitude flight. And already from discussing weather, you can probably see one of the reasons we fly at high altitude is because there's less weather. Can you think of another one, James?
Fuel efficiency on the turbofan engines.
Yeah, exactly. So on behalf of me, thanks very much for listening. I hope you enjoyed the episode. And from my co-host.
Yeah, thanks for listening. Certainly an informative episode, and I hope you guys enjoyed it as much as I did. Don't forget to get in touch with us on any of our social media platforms or through email, and have a good day.